Here we have rainbow trout. They're 6 months old. They were hatched from eggs in January. And when we got these, we had 4,060 of them, 140 pounds. That was 29 fish to the pound. And we got them from the Chelan State Hatchery, thanks to a man by the name of Claire Sackenruder. We got everything free. And he's involved with the state hatchery enough, so it's okay, you know, no hassles. A little louder, okay, I'll stand back a little bit. We also got 11 large rainbow trout, and we put those over in a stream over there, but 8 of those have died, and we suspect it's a shock to their system to be moved from 55 degree water to water that is as cold as 37 degrees in the morning. And for fish that have been growing in warm water for 2 years, it just didn't seem to adjust too well. But we still have 3 that are moving around over there and don't show signs of giving up yet. Okay, we feed these fish 3 times a day. We started out feeding 352 grams per feeding, and now we're feeding 425 grams per feeding. We've lost maybe, what do you say, 100 fish?
No, 50 fish.
50 fish? 50 to 100 fish, and they seem to be doing real well. A lot of those mortalities have been due to fish jumping up on the dock here and
getting caught under the screen.
Dry docking. We had rocks in front of the screen and they were getting caught in front of there, or crawling under the screen, I should say swimming under the screen, and not being able to get out. We've lost about 20 that way. Or when I clean the ponds, they get stepped on, or these cement bricks move around and or fall over on them. And a few of them have had other problems, natural mortalities, which we're not sure what the real reason is, but might be just adjustment problems. The purpose for this little project is to see whether we can raise fish and whether they will grow up here in this water, whether the water warms up enough during the day to get good growth. The best growth, the best temperature to grow trout at is in the mid-50s, 52 to 58 degrees. And our temperatures have been getting up to 11.5 degrees centigrade, which is about 53 degrees. So we're expecting that we'll have pretty good growth. And to this point, we've had, what is it, 2.2 food conversion? 2.0, which is pretty good. That's, if you got 2.0, don't be disappointed. Okay, food conversion, 2 to 1, a food conversion would be 2 pounds of feed to 1 pound of fish. So you feed 2 pounds of pelleted feed and you get 1 pound of flesh. On our first sampling, we thought we were doing really good. We were feeding 3/4 of a pound of feed and getting 1 pound of flesh. That's excellent. But our next 2 samplings kind of brought us down to earth again, and we're not super scientists like we thought maybe we were doing all right at. I clean the ponds, or we clean the ponds, once every 4 days. There's a drain over here that we turn on the valve, and it sucks the waste material out of the pond, and we scrape the sides and the bottom with a broom just to kind of stir it up in the water and let the drain do the rest. Can't get it all out, but you have to get some out to prevent disease or the accumulation of waste material, which would draw on your oxygen supply, and that's called biological oxygen demand, BOD. Some of you might be familiar with that term. So with these cement ponds, you have to clean them out occasionally.
Besides the artificial feed, we're also trying to get into a little bit of natural feeding. We're culturing some earthworms, and when they get started, they should double the population about every 21 days. So, and they just grow, we're using a mixture of compost and manure that we have available readily in the village. And so when we get that started, that should be a good source of food and cheap. And this is a bug light we have out in the middle of the pond. We turn that on at night. It's a black light. It attracts bugs, and they get shot down into the pond, and then the fish can feed on those. And this, I think, is an important area to develop rather than just relying wholly on the commercial feed, because the pelleted feed is made up of about 40% fish meal to begin with, and some people would say that it's scrap fish or whatever that go into this, but I think that a lot of that fish could also be used for human consumption in areas where a good protein source is really needed. So natural foods are an important area to work on developing too.
Why the dock?
Why the dock? Well, this prevents, it supports our bug light, and it also prevents sunburn for the fish, which shows up in a rotting of the fins. So they hide out pretty much underneath there during the day. At night you'll see them going all over the pond. We transferred yesterday, we had a grading box which had slots in the bottom the same size as the screens over there, which are half an inch apart. And the fish that went through we left in this pond, and we took 3 pounds of fish, which was 45 fish of this large size, and brought them over to there to see how they're going to do. Now I'm afraid that there's not going to be enough fish over there to force them to utilize this artificial feed, but hopefully they can get enough natural feed. And we're going to kind of compare the growth in here with the water. It warms up more during the day than it does over there. So see how well those grow, if they can get enough food, and compare them to how the ones in here are doing.
Okay, can you tell them anything about what we will do with the fish eventually?
Hopefully they'll all be harvested and just used for village consumption. We expect to have some harvestable size by this fall, hopefully September, somewhere around that. Some we might have to overwinter. During the winter, the temperatures will get low enough that they won't be able to feed at all. Seeing as fish are cold-blooded animals, their body temperature is the same as the environment. This water gets down to 32 degrees. Still flows, but their body is, it's almost like a hibernation stage. And so they'll be in the water and they won't be feeding. They'll just be living. Their oxygen requirement is really down. The same as the fish do in the creek or in the lakes. They just go for the deep holes and hang out there till the water warms up and they can start to metabolize food again. So we might have to keep some here over the winter. This water keeps flowing all winter long. This, if we increase the flow, could probably keep flowing all winter long too. Last winter this froze up, but this water coming out of the hydro will be running all winter.
Mm-hmm. Many of you have questions. This is an opportunity to learn something about a fish farm.
Nothing you couldn't have in your own backyard if you have a little flow.
When?
What
side?
Repeat the question.
We'll probably harvest the fish 8 inches, I suppose. We might try 10 inches. We haven't really decided what harvestable size is. We're kind of waiting to see what they're going to be, you know.
Okay. Any other questions? Pardon? Will we restock the pond next year? I think that depends on the success of this particular venture. If everything works out as we hope it will, yes, we're going to keep this going. You might transport this home, you know, as an idea. If it fits in your particular area, we hope that these kinds of things will be models that you can learn something from and perhaps use them at some point.
We first wanted to see just if the fish would survive. As far as we know, there's no fish living in Copper Creek. Was that because, you know, it's very steep, and so maybe fish can't migrate up, or maybe it was that the water had too much copper in. So this is an encouraging sign, just that the fish are able to live. Now, whether they're going to be able to grow at a decent rate, you know, that's the second thing we're trying to find out.
An interesting sidelight, when the mine was in operation here, they had biologists and people who were watching the fish at all times. Because one of the stipulations of the forestry department was that the fish in Railroad Creek must always be healthy and happy. And so they had ponds of fish at different places testing the kind of water that was going into Railroad Creek from the mine. There were settling areas in this general area, and so there were fish cultures that were monitored during the mining days. And in reading the files, you know, of the mine, this was one of the things we learned. And they had a running sequence of this sort of thing for the whole 20 years the mine operated. So it's not entirely new in this area, but they were doing it for perhaps a different reason. Again, it was survival, though, to prove that the fish were being taken care of in the area while the mine was in operation. Okay?
Sorry, there are a few fish here of a different strain. I've seen about four or five black ones.
As far as we know, they're all the same strain. Spokane strain of rainbow.
The black ones?
Yeah.
I suspect that's from the fish changing their color if they hang out underneath the raft for an amount of time. And the ones that are lighter, they seem to blend in real well with the background of the pond. Fish can change their color depending on their background. Some are better at it than other species, but most of them, I think, can do it.
Anything more on the fish culture?
Maybe you covered this, but what's your attrition?
What's the what?
Did you lose?
We'd say we have a count of it, but we haven't tallied it up. It's 50 to 100.
About 1%, really. That's very low. I mean, you would consider you could lose 1% in just the shipping, the handling on the way up here. And we lost, I think it was one right after they came in. And out of 4,000, that was great.
Will they attract bears?
That's one of the things that I was anxious to see. We haven't had any, you know, I haven't seen any bears down here. And
no tracks yet.
No tracks.
We're watching. Now, maybe could you toss in a handful of food, or is that an order?
No, well,
dessert for the fish. Peeking in over here.
Maybe we can learn something to
you
about our next trip.
Yeah, that's right. See how they keep. Then we'll go from here over to the store.
I just hope the sun cooperates. If we get over there real quick, maybe we can catch a little bit. And I want to tell you some things about the stove, but while the sun is out, I want to show you that. Be sure you do not get in front of the stove, because without sunglasses, you're going to hurt your eyes. Stand in back, or at least directly off to the side. No further front than that, or you'll burn your eyes. So while the sun is out, I'm going to get the frying pan. And if the sun stays out for 5 minutes, we'll be able to hear hot dogs sizzling and smell it frying. Everybody in back of the line of the stove here.
Let me turn it off.
I'm going to have to turn it to the sun, so get in back of this line.
We want the butter in the frying pan.
We're going to put a little bit of shortening in the pan, and let's put the hot dog in right away. If the sun is out, it'll cooperate. I think it'll cooperate here for a little while.
Can you turn that thing? It's holding part together. The glue wasn't too dry.
Putting the wiener into the frying pan.
The other thing that I'm going to have to do, I've got to get this thing aimed right at the sun. I do that by a little gadget I've got in here. Let's tip it back a little bit. With this wire, with this ball on it, and when that shadow is right over the center there, then I've got it right on the sun. Okay, that's
right
enough. Now, I'm going to hold this over there.
Want some butter?
Let's put a little bit of butter in there.
How much do you want?
Just a little dab.
Like that?
That's fine.
You want to lick off my finger?
Now you can see the shortening is melting in there. And by the way, this is a very crude device. You notice we got to hold it, and periodically we'll have to move it to focus with the sun if you're real ingenious. In fact, you don't have to be real ingenious but figure out some device on which this can rotate with the sun. I see I left the cover somewhere. I think you can see the bottom of that hot dog is already turning a little red from being sunburned.
We left the cover back.
Yeah, I know, I left the cover back in the shop. There isn't enough sun now to really do the job. It should be real bright, but there's a lot of light being cut out by the clouds we have there. The reason I have the long handle here is to get back out of the sun so I don't cast a shadow on there. I want all the sunlight I can on there. When this is operating in full sunlight, I get the equivalent of about a medium burner on an electric stove. Just exactly perfect for bacon and eggs, hamburgers, or hot dogs. The other thing that I need to do and really didn't get a chance to do, I should blacken the bottom of the pan, because black absorbs heat. This shiny aluminum, the bottom side will reflect the heat right back, so I lose a lot of efficiency that way. There are many things that can be done to improve the efficiency of this thing, but again, this is a very crude device. This demonstrates several other things. You notice we came down here late. Well, you've heard a lot about delays in production and cost overruns. Well, this is just part of the demonstration. When the sun is out full and bright, I can have hot dogs done just perfectly in about 10 minutes. Just about the time you want to do it on an electric stove, unless you want to burn them a little bit too. We're just not getting enough sun here to do any good.
Yeah,
the butter did melt.
What's
more? No, I think that's right. Well, we lose our sun again. Whenever you use any device like this, be sure you have either sunglasses or stay behind. Don't ever get in front of it. You'll really burn your eyes. Now, we're just not going to be able to fry it. You want to put your hand there, you can feel the heat. Most of the heat is actually about down in there. The curvature on this is about the size, well, it's the same size curvature, the same curvature as you would have on a 6-foot sphere if you cut it off down at the 4-foot diameter level. And you notice that this is not perfectly round. You notice these sections on here. I've got the curvature, but every 9.5 inches I've got a rib underneath here. Then we cut a section of poster board in pie shape to lay on top of that. So that whole section, 9 inches back here, which tapers down, that heat or that sunlight that strikes this comes back up here and is focused in about a 9-inch circular area. If I focused it all on a pinpoint, I would have had a hole in here already from what little sun we've had. I'm getting about equivalent to 250 to somewhere between 250 and 500 watts heat energy equivalent here. Now, if you or I were to crank a generator, we could turn out about, we could probably keep a 60 watt bulb lit if we were in pretty good condition. So this little 12 square foot of collecting area, about three times as powerful as we are in terms of energy. Am I right on that? Yeah.
Because you wanted to use the mirror, there's no need to try to make a parabolic mirror. It's there for one is enough.
But, this is right, yeah. You may wonder where I got the idea. It wasn't my idea, but as a youngster in a one-room country school, I happened to find a book in the library that talked about solar energy. Believe it or not, that's now, well, over 40, 45 years ago that I read that book. They knew about solar energy then, too. But I didn't do anything about it until my boy, when he was in college, or in high school, got interested in it. I didn't know about it, but when he left for college, I was cleaning up, straightening up his room, moving some stuff out so we could do some other things with that room. I found a book that he had. As a youngster, he was interested in it, and it was a science project book, for a solar science project book. Well, after he was gone to college, and I was sure he wouldn't be home for some weekend or so, I took the book out and I read it, and I had a lot of fun with it. This is a very simple device. I mentioned cost overrun. You may not think this cost very much, but I suspect, even though I got the cardboard free and the wood free, I've probably got about $8 tied up in this thing. By the time you buy glue, aluminum foil, poster board, that's it. If I had to pay the labor I had this morning, I'd be in debt the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I had real good help, by the way. Kurt Johnson, where is he? And the whole Pettinger family came and helped me. I really appreciate it. Wouldn't have had this ready if it hadn't been for them. Well, the sun is not going to cooperate, so you get the idea.
Yeah. Now, I think one of you want to turn it over to Kurt, maybe you can introduce Rick and the former panelists over here, so we can all see that.
Made us all hungry anyway,
huh? How do you fit that in a backpack?
Well, I tell you, I have an idea for backpacking. Well, I like the backpack, too. But I'm going to check with somebody in the plastics industry and get one that's made this way, with every rib being made out of air, and you can blow the air tube up, you see, and with some of this good mylar plastic, which is tremendously good reflective surface if it's done right, you could have a backpack solar stove. Anybody know a plastic industry that I might contact? Okay, Kurt, where's Kurt?
Kurt's right here.
Okay. You know Kurt probably better than I do.
Well, Kurt, again, is working with one of our scholarships, and his project, of course, is a solar project where he's building panels and so on, and I'd just like for Kurt to tell us about it. And I think it's better that he tell you than I try to tell you, because he knows more about it.
Okay, well, if Al's... little demonstration here. This is a process known as the concentrating collector, where you're concentrating the energy from a larger area into a smaller area so you can get higher temperatures. Well, the process I'm using on my solar system is using flat plate collectors, which, in other words, what you're taking is the amount of area from sunlight energy from a particular area and using it completely in that area. You can use either the heat air for a hot air system or heat water for a hot water system, and then this hot water you can use for anything you need to use it for, heating your building, hot water for showers, or even heating your swimming pool. It's a big push now, especially in the California area, for solar heated swimming pools. And the good thing about this is that your storage system is your swimming pool, so you don't have to buy any storage tanks for keeping your hot water in, and you don't need to buy a pump because you have your filtering pump, which works just fine for this type of system. And you're just incorporating your solar heating panels instead of your gas or electric swimming pool heater. And if we start moving right over to where the panels are, and we can tell you what we're doing here and get a better idea. Okay, this system here is for heating hot water for showers that will be installed in the change house for the sauna there. And each of these collectors are approximately 4 by 8 feet, and they have they're a wood frame box with plywood backing on it, and there's 2 inches of styrofoam insulation laid in the bottom of each box. And here's an aluminum sheet. This sheet right here is aluminum, and it's just laid on top of the insulation, and then it's painted flat black, and then the tubing on there is copper tubing, half inch diameter copper tubing, and this is bolted down onto the aluminum with clamps, and it's also painted a flat black. And then there'll be 2 sheets of clear plastic put over top of them, about 4 mil thick plastic, and this is to keep as much of the heat in the box as possible. And I'll be using two sheets, so you get a thermal barrier layer between them, and it'd be like thermal pane glass principle. and so the sun will shine through the plastic and heat up the black plate there, and since you're using black, since that's the best absorber you can get for absorbing the heat, radiating heat from the sun, and then the black aluminum plate will transfer the heat by conduction to the copper tubing, and in the copper tubing will be flowing water, cold water or water from the storage tank, the 300 gallon storage tank over by the trees there, and it'll flow the water from the tank, from the bottom of the tank, which will be the coolest part of the tank, of the water in the tank, through the collectors, and it'll be flowing through this line right here, and it'll come into the bottom of the collectors. The collectors will be sitting up facing south on top of the building there, and this part right here will be the top, and it'll run right along the crest of the building. And so the part where everyone's standing will be the bottom of the system, and the cold water flows in to the bottom and then is pumped through the tubing and comes out at the top, and the three collectors are hooked in parallel, which is more efficient than running them in series. In other words, running the same water through all the collectors. So this is running a third of the water that's pumped through the system will go to each collector, and it'll be collected here at the top and then circulated back into the top of the storage tank. And so the total flow rate for the whole system is about 4.5 gallons a minute. In other words, 1.5 gallons a minute per collector. And this is a pretty standard flow rate for any collector this size that's commercially made. And then the tank is 300 gallons, and it'll be insulated with approximately about 6 inches of glass wool insulation around to keep as much of the heat into it as possible. And that's very important. That solar energy is conservation. Is once you gather this heat, you got to store it, and you got to keep it, and you got to cut down on the amount of as much of the losses as you can, or else you'll lose your efficiency of your system. And since you can only gather the heat during the daytime when the sun's out shining, you got to be able to store this for nighttime usage and for say the next day usage if it's cloudy. And the water flowing from the cold water feed into our storage tank is approximately 42 degrees, and hopefully on a clear hot day in July we'll be able to get the water by the end of the day, a 10-hour collection period, up to approximately 100 degrees. And this is with these three collectors, and we have room to place another collector if it's desired later on to build another and bring it up farther, and this would bring it up approximately to 120 degrees. And that's basically what this system is, and be sitting on the south side of the roof there, and there'll be a third horsepower pump will be circulating it, and also there's a control system that we have on order right now for the system that will sense the temperature of the water leaving the collectors, the hottest water in the system, and also sense the temperature at the water leaving the storage tank going into the collector system. So then you'll get a temperature difference there, and if the temperature difference is great enough to heat the water up, to add any heat to the water, the thermostat on the control system will turn the pump on and circulate the water through the system. So then on a day like today, when the sun goes, clouds cover the block out the sun, the pump will automatically turn off, so then you won't be circulating your water through your collector system and losing the heat back out. And then when the sun comes out from behind the clouds and starts heating these plates back up, and they get a hot enough temperature, it'll turn the pump back on and circulate the water through the system. And so this, you'll get a more efficient system than manually turning it on in the morning and turning it off at night. And so it'll be going an on and off process, and then on a clear day, it'll run it all day long. And if you didn't have the mountains on the south side there to block out the sun in the wintertime, you could run the system during the wintertime and heat up the water to not quite 100 degrees, but you'll get it warmer than what it is coming in. And you'd have to have more collectors to get it up to 100 degrees, because during the wintertime you don't get near as much of the sunlight, intense sunlight, as you do during the summertime.
Thank you. And any questions?
Any questions on this system?
Yeah, here's a couple of questions.
I just wondered why you don't have more
copper tubing running?
Well, to get an optimum design for a system like this, is you want to get as much as you can out of it with the least amount of expenditures. And since that's why we went to the aluminum plate in the back, so the aluminum plate will gather heat in between these copper tubes and then transfer it by conduction to the tubing, and it'd be more efficient if you had several, a lot of covered with copper tubing, but then your cost to your collectors would be outrageous and you wouldn't be able to afford to do it.
I just wondered why you don't have more copper tubing running.
Well, to get an optimum design for a system like this, is you want to get as much as you can out of it with the least amount of expenditures. And since that's why we went to the aluminum plate in the back, so the aluminum plate will gather heat in between these copper tubes and then transfer it by conduction to the tubing, and it'd be more efficient if you had several, a lot of covered with copper tubing, but then your cost to your collectors would be outrageous and you wouldn't be able to afford to do it. And just offhand, each of these collectors, if you bought them commercially, this size of collector would probably cost you around $380 to $400 for each one of these collectors.
How much did it cost you?
Oh, I don't know. It's running around Houston. Thank you for the financial aspect. But okay, well, the wood was all free, and the insulation, the styrofoam insulation, 2-inch thick, doesn't cost very much at all. And the aluminum sheets, they're 16-inch thick and they're 4x8. Now, I don't know what they're selling for now, but it's not that much. Is compared to an optimum system, for the best system you can get, you'd use copper plate, because it has about twice as much of the heat gathering ability and transmissivity of the aluminum. It'd be transferring twice as much, so you wouldn't have to have quite as thick of a plate, but then your cost of copper is just tremendous compared to aluminum. And then the copper tubing, I don't know what the is per foot, but I think it was a 6 strings of approximately 7 feet long, so that'd be about 42 feet of it per collector. So I don't know, you might know what the cost of, anybody know what the aluminum and tubing is?
Yeah, the half inch copper is about 40 cents a foot, something like that.
So that'd be about $20 for that. And you may have any idea on aluminum how much that sells for? I don't know, it's not that much compared to around the Northwestern.
So how long will it last?
Well, since we're using plastic on the top of it, that plastic may have to be changed every so often, maybe every year or two, but since that's fairly cheap, it's and also since the system we operate only during the summertime, and since there's no sunlight hardly in the wintertime, because the sun comes out for about an hour right across the straddle there, saddle, that it's impractical to keep up during the wintertime, and also with the large amount of snow, it tear the system apart, so it'll be taken down each fall and put up in the springtime. That this system should last for several years, and a commercially made system like this, his lifetime is at least 20 years, around 20 years. And they're using glass plates on the top. So I'd imagine that these would last for the boxes for, I'd imagine, at least 10 years. And then the plastic is fairly cheap, and the top one would probably have to be changed every year or two.
So, how much does it cost to put glass on?
Why don't we use glass?
Because the cost of glass is quite a bit, and since this is experimental, we didn't want to venture into that and buy that much glass right away. But, and then also in the glass, you have to worry about your breakage problem. And if you got a 4x8 sheet of glass, you have to go about a quarter inch thick, I think it's something like that, or an eighth inch thick. And if somebody, you got a storm and blew some material out there, or a bird dropped something, stone or something on here, or someone, or somehow some stone gets thrown at it, it'll break your glass, and you have to replace it, and that's quite a bit of expenditure. And then taking it down and moving it around, it's when you're moving around that much glass, it's quite heavy, and also with the moving the boxes around, someone might drop the chain from the winch on it and from the crane and bust the glass. And a lot of the companies nowadays are going to fiberglass, which doesn't break as easily, and they get almost as good of collectability through the fiberglass as they can the glass, and they can go thinner plates on there, and it's a little bit cheaper, and they don't have to worry about the breakage problem as much.
Wow. Thank you.
32.
Thank you.
So it'll be about 100 Also, one more thing. We got another demonstrator model of a solar distillation center. You might be able to talk about that and show people what we're doing with that. This right here is a small experimental demonstrator model of a solar water distilling unit. What it is, it's got a 2x3 foot black pan on the bottom, painted flat black, and it got about an inch of water sitting in that, and then this plastic structure here is similar to a greenhouse structure. It's a similar principle as a greenhouse. What it does is the sun heats up the black pan in there on the bottom from the sunlight, and then that heats the water up, and since this is, try to keep this as fairly airtight as possible, the water evaporates off from the pan and it saturates the air inside the structure here, and so you get your air is saturated with water, and then the air is a little bit cooler than the water temperature, and it's so then you got saturated water and air in here, and then it comes up and it condenses on the plastic cover here, and it's a slanted roof on there, so that when it condenses on here, and the plastic is cooler than the air inside, so it'll condense the water, and then the water will run down the roof here, and there's a trough in there. Took a 2-inch plastic tubing and cut it in half, and it's just mounted to the front side here. And so the water, when it condenses, like you see here, and it'll run down the side there, the roof, and it's collected in the trough, and then it's circulated out through tubing to this glass jug here, and this is distilled water. And what it is, the basic principle is the principle of evaporation and collecting the water vapor and changing it back to liquid form by cooling it down, and then you're collecting distilled water, and what it's doing is it's precipitating all the minerals out of the water into the bottom of the pan, and this can be used for like on the coastline where you got salt water and you want some fresh water. You can put your salt water in the pan and it'll evaporate the water out of the salt water, and then it'll run down here and you collect and you got fresh water, and then your salt will condense and precipitate out on the bottom of the pan. And there are several of these.
Put that on your eggs.
Yes. Right. And they have several of these type of units, large plants down in the Mexico and Peru area along the coastline where they don't have the fresh water that they need, but they have all the salt water they can get from the ocean. So they take these systems, and they have about 1,000 square feet of collector area, and they have like 100 feet long and 10 feet wide. And they have a little bit different where they just got the plastic covering the top of the tray, and they circulate air through these things, through these collector trays, and the air is saturated with the water vapor in there, and then they run the saturated air through a cooling tower like they have at the nuclear plants and stuff and different places for cooling the air, and they run the air through the cooling tower, and it cools the air down, and the water is liquefied and is collected at the bottom of these cooling towers, and then they run the air back through the system, so they got a closed system. They just keep recirculating the air, saturating it. It's heated up through the collectors and saturated with the water vapor, running through the cooling tower, cooling the air down, and it's saturating the water, condensing the water back out of the air, and then they're collecting this fresh water. And some of these systems they got down there producing like 5,000 gallons a day. And in the areas along coastline where the fresh availability of fresh water is really limited, so they have quite a bit of these systems going in there. And the only electricity that power they're using is to run their pumps to circulate the air or the water through it. And so they're very in remote areas, they're very practical for this type of situation. But then if you had an area where you can heat up the water electrically or something like that very cheaply, that'd be more efficient, because you're only getting out of this as much as you can sunlight you can put into it and heat the water up. but it's, I'm getting approximately a pint a day from this size of system. And you can use that, you could build one of these at your home, put it in your backyard and distill a pint of water a day, or you may go big and get more and you have distilled water for your batteries or for your iron. And you're not putting any power into it at all. And the cost of a system like this is practically nothing. It's just whatever you pay for the plastic and then the scrap wood. All the materials I put into this were all scrap materials I found around from the area. So there's no, as far as cost-wise, there was nothing for to build this system. And then on the bottom here, we have styrofoam insulation. This is to keep as much of that heat in the pan as possible, so it's not going down into the bottom, underneath the dill and circulate it out. And you want to keep it as airtight as possible, so I got it caulking around the edges to seal it up. Is there any questions?
Yeah, any questions?
Here's a good question.
Can you distill anything else in there?
We're thinking about it.
Okay, any other questions? Any other questions? I think you had your hand up. Did you ever get yours answered?
Yeah, over yeah. there.
Well, okay.
What's the angle
for this here? It really doesn't matter because since the front is all plastic and so the sunlight is coming in, and it's hitting this, and also in this back here is plywood and it's painted white, so if you wanted a white or a silver color, light color, so what sunlight misses the pan is going to shoot at an angle back here, it'll hit this plate and reflect back in, so you gather more heat from the sun than just the 6 square feet area. But as far as the angle, it really doesn't matter, just as long as you got a steep enough slope so that the water will run down it instead of dripping off and back into the pan.
Good. Any other questions? Now, there's one more thing down here. Is Herman around? Did he go back?
He went back.
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you, I hoped Herman would be here. Maybe he would have told you. But that wheel that he's making up there, the water wheel, that's going to be installed right down here, about where those evergreen trees are, right next to the stream of water where the trout are that's running down through there. There'll be a flume carrying the water from right up above, right by the hydroelectric plant, carrying it up so that it gets up as high as that wheel is. You see, 12 feet high, it'll flow by gravity, and then when it hits the wheel, of course it'll turn the wheel, and there'll be a generator attached to that, electric generator, which will produce enough electricity that we can light this park with that wheel. So that it won't take any, that is the energy to light this area will be provided by that wheel. Furthermore, we could attach a grinder at the end of the axle on that, bring the wheat down from the kitchen and grind the wheat for breakfast or for the bread. See, so this is really going back to the time of the water wheel, when that was the main source of power. And when electricity gets dear and other fuels become hard to get, this is one way you can do it. So we want to have a working model of a wheel. Now, Herman built one of these wheels in where? New Guinea.
New Guinea.
Yeah. And it was a working wheel. Now, and you could do the same thing here. So, if you have any questions, I would hope that you would talk to Herman about it. You know, he's a remarkable person, and we're very fortunate that he's here and that he's doing this for it. And
what was he doing in New Guinea? Really, was he a missionary?
Who can answer that?
He's a lay missionary.
Mission builder, I think.
And a mission builder, yeah.
Is he a contractor by trade?
Mechanic, I think.
Mechanic, Sig says here, I think was mainly his background.
He's in his 80s, isn't he?
Yeah, he's 80, what, 84? Young man.
He went to New Guinea up in...
Yeah, right.
He was in the 50s when he went over.
Got his pilot's license at 79.
Yeah, he just recently got a pilot's license. He decided he wanted to learn to fly. So, you know.
Rudy, can you say anything about your experiment over on the tailing?
You mean the plants, yeah. and so on. Who's here that could talk about that? Hal here is our expert.
The grass plots up there.
Well, and then how about the evergreen trees here?
Yeah. In the black section.
Okay.
It's over on the other side. It's unidentified. This is new. And we're trying to plant grass over there. We seeded about a week and a half ago, and we haven't seen any signs of germination yet, so we're going to have to probably lime or fertilize or do something.
Well, the trees seem to be growing, or how long they've been in there?
Well, I really don't know. They've been there for a long time. We just, you know, worked around those. We didn't just plant them.
Some of them have come up of their own accord.
Some of the deciduous trees, I think.
Different people have planted. Some of them are 3 years old, and there are just a few in there that are natural, came up natural. Any other questions? This is our laboratory. Yes, I do.
Rudy,
yeah.
I thought I'd mention the reason that some things grow here is that this was originally good soil. It has had some tailings mixed with it, so that has made it marginal, which means with normal variation, there are some spots where the soil is good enough, things will grow, other spots where there's enough tailings where it won't grow, and of course if you get on top of the tailings and not much of anything grows, unless you add lime and fertilizer, or unless nature washes in some good topsoil from up in the mountains with a lot of rain on it, eventually nature takes care of it and heals it up.